Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is October 12th, 2017, and this is episode 56. Politicoast is the podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Today, we're going to talk about all the federal government taxes that we've been trying to avoid. And we're going to talk about casinos and the scams that are happening there in BC. And of course, a roundup of quick takes. But first, we have to thank our premier sponsor, as always, Lindsay Tedds. Thank you for helping make this show possible. And a quick reminder that if you're listening to this on Friday, when I guess I'll hopefully have this out, and you live in the city of Vancouver, so hopefully a dozen or so of our listeners, maybe that, remember that Saturday's voting day in the Vancouver by-election. You can find information on that at vancouver.ca/by-election. Or if you like using the phone, you can use 311 and you'll get the details, I guess. And you can also just go back and listen to the two shows we released last week for the Housing and Homelessness Forum, where the major candidates debated different issues. And you can listen to episode 55 for our thoughts on both that debate and the candidates more generally. And if that's not helpful enough, you can also find questionnaires that the candidates have responded to from groups like Abundant Housing Vancouver, the Vancouver Tenants Union, and the City of Vancouver's Renters Advisory Council on their websites, and we'll have those links in the show notes at politicoast.ca. And if anyone knows any other questionnaires we should be mentioning, just tweet them at us and we'll retweet them, I guess. So for our first segment, a taxing headache, I think it's finally time we talk about these small business tax changes.
Yeah, we've been kind of dreading talking about this because I think we both see this as a bit of a tempest in a teapot situation.
And no offense to any tax economists who are listening, but they can sometimes be a very boring topic, especially when it's focused on such a narrow segment of the population, which neither of us are in. So it's not that we can't talk about issues that don't affect us, but we don't care as much about them. But since the Liberals announced their proposals in July, it's grown and grown as an issue. And I don't know whether that's the effective lobbying efforts of doctors and other high-income individuals, whether it's the Conservative Party taking it up as the issue they're going to die on, or maybe win the next election on, or if just the media loves finding the tax and spend Liberals as a narrative. Do you want to run us through the basics of what the Liberals are proposing?
So the Liberals are looking at changing how small business taxes work in the country, and they've put out this proposal before it goes to consultations, committees, all that stuff. So this is kind of the first public step in it, and specifically, they're looking at changing the rules around passive investments in held within a company, the capital gains taxes, and income sprinkling, basically where you get to pay out dividends to family members. About 50,000 families that use this, and basically the income sprinkling is where a family member is not actually involved in the company's day-to-day operations and that sort of thing, still gets paid a dividend out of the company. And if, you know, if the main person involved in the company and then the other family member are in different income tax brackets, that can actually save a fair bit of money. And the Liberals are looking to kind of close that and basically only allow family members who are actively involved in the companies to get paid dividends.
So this applies to farmers who might have the person working the fields and selling the crop. Like my dad's a farmer and he's self-incorporated, so he could, if he had a bumper crop one year and actually made probably over $150,000 or something like that, write off some of that income as my mom's or even my brother's because he still lives at home, and just basically say, doesn't even need to say they worked the farm or helped in any way, just splits that, and that lets the tax be split. It's a sort of income splitting, which is a separate issue. Instead, the Liberals are looking at a, quote, reasonableness test that would more see if, like you said, their those children and partners are actually contributing to the business. And then you would be able to deduct a reasonable salary. And what's reasonable, I guess it's, is your partner working as a receptionist? Well, then they can deduct whatever a receptionist makes, 40, 50,000 a year, maybe, depending on the place, from their total income. This is big with doctors because a lot of GPs are self-incorporated and they run a small clinic and want to be able to find ways around paying taxes like we all do. These have been characterized a lot as loopholes and closing loopholes, but that gets a bit iffy because they're not illegal. People aren't, these are features almost of the tax that were put into the tax code. And I think the big issue that the Liberals are going after and what the NDP would be supportive of saying is these are tax forgivenesses almost for not actually contributing anything additional. So this isn't money that you've earned to from making widgets or providing more services. It's just, you know, you're rich enough that you can hide a bit more money from the tax man.
Yeah, and I believe the contribute to the business also includes like investing in within the business. So if you, you know, put up a bunch of money to help get that started or something, I'm not sure on this, but I do believe you can get the more favorable tax treatment under this new plan. So, you know, there's that concern, but it's not as big a one. Well, that's but I've seen it kind of thrown out there as this is going to be a disincentive to invest.
Well, and that's the first thing all the conservatives are, and those are throwing up is, oh, now some people's taxes could go up 70% or something. But that falsely and wrongly assumes that people aren't smart enough to use other vehicles and mechanisms to not get through loopholes, but find ways to avoid paying taxes. And if you're hiring an accountant who knows about things like income splitting and passive investments, which weren't phrases I knew before this summer, then you probably have an accountant who can tell you, oh, you should incorporate in this way, and your taxes will probably still go up. But the worst case scenarios are overplayed, I think.
Yeah, and well, in theory, people making kind of upper middle class income can be affected by this. It's worth pointing out that in order to go through this whole rigmarole and whatnot, you actually generally need a fair bit more income than that to make it worth the time and the expense of hiring all the people and figuring and getting all this tax paperwork done and stuff to get it to the point where you can actually get a significant savings. Because, you know, once you pay your accountant and your tax lawyer a whole bunch of money to do this, if you're only, you know, net a couple hundred bucks at the end of it, it's not really worth it.
Yeah, the Globe and Mail, we found a really good analysis. Unfortunately, it's behind a paywall, but we'll put a link in the show notes, where they looked at four sort of model families. One, I guess, closer to the median income, which is more like 50,000 for a family. One who's right at the limit, one or two who are in the high income earner realms. And they found it's really only people have those incomes over $150,000 a year. And the Globe concludes that even for those business owners, the combined weight won't, quote, put them in the poorhouse or result in the failure of their business. But like you say, they need to rejig their retirement plans.
Yeah, and the failure of the business is the other thing that I've seen in a few talking points. And it's really not true. I mean, this is all about money that's coming out of the business to individuals as personal income. It does not affect what happens within the business or reinvestment decisions within the business or any of that stuff. It's only when it comes out to an individual as personal income.
Yeah, there was one thing in the Globe and Mail analysis that did strike me as pretty high. It was when an individual sells their business, or even if they sell it to a family member, that they could face tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxes that they wouldn't have otherwise faced. And that's still assuming, I guess, no other shelters or ways around.
The capital gain stuff was the part that also kind of stuck out to me the most as this is, you know, maybe a little overboard in terms of just how big a tax jump it is. You know, I'll leave it to the tax economists out there to say whether or not that's justified, but it is a pretty big step in that one respect. The rest of the stuff, it's a lot more minor. Yeah, and so the other part of this is the passive investments, and this is basically where someone's effectively running a investment fund within their own business as a way to save for retirement, more or less doubling it as an RRSP sort of type thing. And this kind of being the other controversial part is the how am I going to save for retirement if I'm, you know, running a business and barely scraping by and all that stuff. But as the analysis in the Globe shows, it's, you know, you have to generally have a pretty high income before you effectively run out of RRSP room and can't get that to work at all anymore. And this is also a mechanism that, you know, the average person doesn't necessarily have access to. And, you know, whether or not you think taxes should be lower or higher, or think that there should be more or less incentives to save for retirement, there really isn't a good case on why one group of people should get a different tax treatment courtesy of their chosen profession.
Especially high-income earners in a country like Canada, where we ostensibly have a progressive tax system, which equates to the more you earn, the more you pay. And it's these kind of opt-outs almost, or preferential treatments, that redistribute wealth from the poor to the rich. And now it's trying to reverse that.
If there is an issue with whether or not entrepreneurs can save for retirement, that would seem to be the sort of thing we should look at, maybe changing the RRSP contribution limit, something like that, rather than allowing this shelter of passive investments that, you know, really don't have anything to do with a business. Like, there's no reason a medical practice needs to be owning, you know, stocks in RBC or anything.
Well, that hasn't stopped the conservatives from screaming bloody murder and every day talking about Plumber Joe, who the Globe and Mail discounts won't actually be affected, but the conservatives are screaming that he will. And I think they're trying to play to that everyone thinks they're middle class, but this doesn't even really affect the middle class. And so everyone wants to be wealthy. That almost American dream approach of let's cut taxes for the rich or keep advantages for the rich, because then if you're not there, at least when you get there, because eventually you'll get there, right? You work hard and then you'll get advantage of those. And if they're taking those away, well, they're taking away your future privileges.
Yeah, and there's also the kind of argument that this is going to be a disincentive against startups and all that stuff. And that's, I think, the other part that kind of plays into that, but it's a little tangential too, is that, you know, why would someone go to all the trouble of investing in this stuff without that? And that's kind of been their other point, is that it's, you know, going to harm the small business sector.
I think the smartest thing I've seen anyone say about it, and I'm sure this will make our tax economist friends happy, is the entire tax code should probably be just rewritten from the ground up. But barring that, I'm fine with minor tweaks like this that try to at least bring some more fairness to this. But in spite of all of that, the anger has even convinced Liberal MP Wayne Long to go against the party on this, and he actually voted against it on one, I think, sending the idea to committee. So Long is the former president of Scotiaview Seafood Inc., which is a small seafood brokerage company. So he personally knows firsthand the struggles of small businesses and believes that this is fracturing the caucus. Meanwhile, you had Liberal MP Wayne Easter calling the communications plan for it god-awful. I think a number of other MPs are kind of disappointed at the Liberals' comms. Maybe they're fine with the plan itself, but just don't think the fairness arguments are getting through.
Yeah, and that's actually been the most kind of interesting part of this, is just how badly the government's fallen down on the comms aspect. Like, it's one of those things that you think would be an easy sell, you know, make the tax code fairer, all of this stuff, and the Liberals, you know, in theory, should be able to sell that pretty well. Like, you know, it's keeping with their brand. It's should be the sort of thing Justin Trudeau could easily sell, and they've just not had a good go of it.
And one thing I think I've heard from NDP and progressive think tank circles is initially I think they all thought this was going to be a sleeper issue that would just kind of sail through. And being on the more left side, they didn't want to openly applaud the Liberals lest they drag in conservative ire to it or just almost waste their time applauding the Liberals. But then the backlash came and groups like the CCPA and others had to put together their, actually, these aren't bad changes. We actually like them. Then they're playing defense because they didn't want to do the Liberals' offense for them.
Yeah, I do think they underestimate the Liberals in general, and almost everyone, in fact, underestimated how much of a backlash there was going to be. But they probably shouldn't have, because, you know, this does affect some fairly influential groups. You know, the Canadian Medical Association, farmers, and, you know, on one hand, you kind of got to applaud the Liberals for going after this because, you know, politicians in this country have, you know, a giant hard-on for small businesses, and it's the sort of thing that is not what you would expect a typical politician to go against, and for that reason alone, they probably should have expected some pushback on this.
I really question the farmer's line. Like, having come from a small family farm, there were a lot of years where I think we didn't make any money because hail destroyed all our crops. So my dad had to rely on crop insurance to basically allow him to seed the next year. And we were never rolling in the money. A lot of farm money does go back into it. So I feel like there's this almost two level. There's the family farm where it's literally one or two people working it. And then there's the increasingly corporatization of farms just because it's so much easier too. And I think they're the ones who are benefiting from this, but maybe I never looked at my family's books. So maybe my dad was benefiting from these things.
Yeah. I've seen some numbers that suggest that farmers, or at least some farmers in particular sectors, are generally fairly well off. But those are probably the, you know, dairy farmers and farmers who own large tracts of land.
Yeah. We just had some wheat and canola, and that doesn't pay the bills, I guess, or pay a lot of bills.
So circling back to Wayne Long, as punishment for his breaking of ranks, the Liberals have removed him from two committee positions, the Standing Committee on Human Resources, Skills, and Social Development, and the Status of Persons with Disabilities, as well as the Standing Committee on Access to Information, Privacy, and Ethics.
So when you vote against your party, especially when your party's in government, on what's one of its signature things it's trying to push through, you have to expect some consequences. I'm actually surprised they didn't fully remove him from caucus, I think.
That might be a bit overkill.
It's happened for lesser votes, I think. So I think this is a good slap on the wrist.
It's not like he did anything crazy like become speaker.
Yeah. I guess the Liberals probably are facing more internal dissent over this, so they wanted to send a bit of a message, but also not start losing votes left, right, and center and really breaking their party apart. And having independents can be a bit of a risk. The Liberals have a strong majority, but you don't want to lose it through by-elections and kicking people out of your party. So, but despite the Liberals' flubbing of the communication rollout, ECOS did do a poll around the end of September, early October on this. They actually called up 4,800 people, which is more than double what I usually see in these polls. So credit to them for really caring about this. I'm hoping they asked other questions. But they did find a plurality supported the Liberals' proposals. 49% of Canadians said they were in favor of this to 44% who are opposed, which is actually closer than I'd expect given all the rhetoric. I thought for how much has been covered on this, all you'd know is it's kind of bad. I guess maybe there's not that much sympathy for doctors. Polling on these issues can always be kind of interesting. When C-51 was first being rolled out, the Conservatives' anti-terror legislation, a majority did support it. And then the Liberals and NDP especially hammered on it for so long that public opinion actually did swing. And so I think that 44% against has come about through the Conservatives and these lobby groups making their case frankly, pretty effectively, whether they'll be able to get a majority opposition to this and potentially move the Liberals to roll back. I know the Liberals have already talked about changing some of the rollout. They've said they'll loosen a bit of the rules and play with it because it started as a white paper and now it's moving more toward legislation. I'm not sure it's actually become a bill yet.
No, I believe they've just started the consultations on it within the last week or two. So yeah, as far as I know, there has not been a bill introduced yet for this, just a proposal out there. But that's not the end of the Liberals' tats troubles. This last week, the CRA announced they were going to be looking at employee discounts as a taxable benefit and kind of enforcing the rules on that. So, you know, if you work at a store and, you know, get 10% off merchandise or something when you buy there, according to the CRA, that would now be taxable and employers would have to track that. People would have to report on their income taxes. It would be just another taxable benefit that would now be, well, enforced and taxed.
So the Income Tax Act under subsection 6.1 says that a person's annual income should include, quote, benefits of any kind, whatever, received or enjoyed by the taxpayer by virtue of their office of or employment. So the CRA and the bureaucrats have to take the language in the Income Tax Act and interpret it. I'm familiar very well with how much interpretation they've read into the very small amount the Income Tax Act has to say about charities and a whole bunch of past court rulings. But this is one of those cases where they go, all right, what does that mean when it comes to your employer offering you 15% off shirts at Forever 21? And how they were doing it was they were only considering that as taxable income if what you paid was actually less than the amount your employer bought it for. So a lot of shirts, I think, are bought for like half the price they're on sale for at the store. So that $20 discount shirt is actually, they probably only paid about $10. So if your employee is paying it for $8, then they'd have to add $2 onto their income at the end of the year.
Yeah, and not every business does that. And like when I worked at Future Shop way back when, it was cost plus 10%. And on some items, that was actually more expensive than the actual retail price, which goes to show you how small the margins in some retail businesses are. So yeah, like that would not have been taxed at all. But under this new rule, it would be, or this new interpretation.
But this turned out to be pretty controversial because the idea of taxing what are mostly minimum wage earners in retail jobs for non-fungible benefits, but you do get a product, but you're essentially spending money to have to then pay taxes on it, which nothing about this really makes that much sense. And so the National Revenue Minister, Diane Lebouthier, she told CRA almost immediately to reverse the decision. And Trudeau jumped to Twitter to say, let me be blunt, we are not going to tax anyone's employee discounts. And I think the initial reaction, which I think I saw someone on my Facebook reshare from Canadian taxpayers, was like, oh, this is the Liberals digging into your pockets again, was wrong. Because as far as I can tell, this was a bureaucratic decision. This was someone at the CRA looking at the Income Tax Act and trying to figure out, what do we tell employers about what they need to track? And someone fucked up.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, the butt does still stop with the minister on this one. And this was clearly a bad move on the CRA's part from a political perspective for exactly the reason you mentioned, which is a lot of the people getting these benefits are, you know, minimum wage workers who, you know, work in retail and get, you know, a store discount or something. And it's really not a good look to be going after those sort of people. Like everyone I know who still working in retail was, you know, livid about this. And between, you know, this and the other tat stuff, it was also starting to shape a narrative of going after the little guy, whether it be the little guy in the business world or the little guy in the
actual little guy.
Yeah. The little guy in the employee side of things, both sides. It just was not a good look on the Liberals and kind of compounded their problems.
But I think they reacted quick enough that this will be out of the news by next week. The small business tax changes, I'm sure we're going to have to keep hearing about for months and months, which is going to be exhausting, but maybe that'll give us an excuse to do an interview on it and find out if we were wrong about everything we said.
I'm sure we'll hear from some of our more knowledgeable listeners on TATS says about this one if we were wrong.
But I'm glad we managed to have about a 20-minute conversation about taxes and pretty much agree on everything.
Yeah, we're not likely to do that again, probably. Moving on to segment two, blackjack but no busts. The BC casinos have been in the news because there's been some less than above board behavior happening there regarding some money laundering.
So a lot of credit has to go to the Vancouver Sun and Post Media for filing a lot of really smart FOIs and doing real journalism to get a number of memos, I guess, between government ministers and the RCMP and constructing the story of essentially what's been going on in BC casinos. And it's pretty shocking, frankly. The RCMP has basically concluded that organized crime in BC casinos is, quote, a viable threat to public safety. Another memo talks about how money going through BC casinos has links to terrorist organizations, possibly. So it's basically going on is there's, I guess, an underground banking network of criminals who are putting money into chips at the River Rock Casino and other casinos around BC and transferring those chips to high-rolling Chinese gamblers from Macau.
Well, it's the gambling capital of Asia.
And then I guess they check out before they've spent all their money, but what's essentially happening is we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars a year are being funneled through our casinos from drug sales and other kinds of things, including cocaine around the lower mainland. And that money is going to mostly China, but also I saw Peru and Mexico mentioned.
Iran came up there, which is, I believe, where the terrorist links might have come from. Just there's, a couple of companies from Iran that are suspected to be involved.
And one of the memos mentioned that the amount of money going through in 1 year accounted for 10% of BC's casino revenue for the government, which is an incredible amount and almost a disincentive to crack down on it when you have that much money flowing into the government. And it turns out that one of these memos even warns that it was the BC Liberals who in 2009 decided to disband the Integrated Illegal Gambling Enforcement Team that we had. And Mike De Jong, who was finance minister in 2016, received warnings about this. And these memos all came out around April or spring this year. So there's this large amount, and it seems like it's mostly on the BC Liberals, but now they're in opposition, so it's the NDP that gets to deal with this. And David Eby is basically, as Attorney General, has hired Peter German, who's a former deputy commissioner of the RCMP, an expert on money laundering and now a lawyer, to do a full independent review of this and try to come up with some kind of idea of how to crack down on this. I guess a couple times it's fallen down a little bit when casinos try to track how much cash people are coming in through. Like if someone walks in, says, oh, can you convert this $100,000 to chips? They might go, where did you get that $100,000 in cash? Not like through a bank account. I don't go to the casino, so I don't know how these things work.
One of the individuals mentioned in the story here, it was explicitly noted that he was doing a lot of this in small bills too, which is also suspicious with that high volume of money, but in small bills.
This is like bad crime movie level of ridiculous, like walking into a casino with a briefcase full of 20s and being like, please convert this to chips. Here you go, sir. Oh, I'm going to cash my chips in now. Everything up here is above board. And this is, I guess, just what's been going on. I did see notes that this is not something that happens anywhere else in Canada. It's just another part of our fun Wild West reputation, I guess. And I'm not sure either of us have any hot takes or political analyses to offer here other than this is ridiculous and seems like it's going to be a mess for everyone to deal with.
Yeah, I expect it's going to fall more on the Liberals because not only did it happen during their tenure, but the decision to disband the Integrated Illegal Gambling Enforcement Team was probably not a good decision in retrospect. And it's just not a good look for them.
And Mike DeJong is now running for leader, isn't he?
Yes, he is. So this is going to be one of those questions that's likely to dog him a bit on the campaign trail.
Meanwhile, the BCNDP and David Eby himself are already busy with a number of other scandals and issues. BC Hydro's a bit of a mess. ICBC is an absurd mess. And now that he has to add on fixing BC Lottery Commission, when they also have other things they promised to do, and they have to deal with the federal government's marijuana legalization, it's a busy year for Mr. Eby. Well, moving on to quick takes. Speaking of people who are involved in the BC Liberal leadership race, Todd Stone has officially launched his leadership bid on Tuesday, becoming the eighth candidate. We've already talked a bit about him because it was not really a secret that he was going to join, but now it's official.
Yeah, so he's the former transportation minister and MLA for Kamloops South and is currently the municipal affairs critic. So in his launch, he talked about how the Liberals learned some tough lessons and is calling for a major expansion of childcare, early childhood education, as well as better support for people caring for relatives with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and more mental health services.
And those are definitely, I think, interesting things to take on for him at first, because one of the NDP's big pitches is this $10 a day childcare and the mental health ministry that they've set up, and that all seems to fit in his. So I almost wonder if he's pitching himself more towards the centrist, even the liberal end, essentially, of the BC Liberals. Well, he can let other candidates go off more into the conservative end. Of course, he's also reiterating the importance of being a good economic steward and supporting small businesses and making sure BC is a good place to invest in.
Speaking of the transportation file, John Horgan's come out this week and said that the portmanteaus are, well, staying gone. And this is in response to criticisms over the much, much increased traffic flow over the Portman Bridge and the ensuing traffic problems that's created.
There's one estimate that there's an additional 30,000 trips per day happening over the Portman Bridge, so I guess 15,000 people each way, and more accidents and
delays,
just frustrations and delays.
I know my co-workers who live in that part of the metro region, commute across there, are not happy with the increased commute times.
So he and Transportation Minister Claire Trevanna are saying the traffic will eventually balance out, and I guess the idea is people will shift over to other bridges, but it might happen a little bit, but I think it's still going to be, it's a nice bridge to drive across, so it's going to be high volumes in high times.
And the history of road expansions, which this was, is they tend not to just even out, and they, now that there's more lanes accessing south of the Fraser, you get more people trying to cross there because it's now, it becomes more economical to live out there and commute in. All of these things just add to more congestion and more road trips. And you know, I think this is a pretty clear case of how road pricing keeps traffic down, because before the tolls were removed, traffic over the bridge was much more manageable. And now there's less incentive to bundle your trips across there together or avoid an unnecessary trip to Burnaby or whatever. And with the tolls gone, you know, people might have carpooled before, now driving solo because it's just not worth the hassle.
I really wanted to say every trip to Burnaby is unnecessary, but I don't actually have anything against the town. It just felt like an easy dig. What was interesting in the article, though, is Horgan, I guess, was asked about road pricing and whether it could ever come back in some form, maybe on a, let's say, more sensical form than just here's two random bridges that are new and deserve to be tolled. And he said, that's an issue being addressed by the Mayor's Council currently, and we're going to await that consultation and see what they have to say. So he didn't actually rule it out and seemed reasonably open to just listening to what the mayors have to say. And if they say we need a downtown congestion charge and toll all the bridges, he might have somewhat talked himself into a corner there, unless...
Yeah, I'm wondering how much of this is just the NDP not wanting to pick a fight with the Metro mayors at this time, because road pricing is one of those things that doesn't always sit well with kind of the NDP's end of the spectrum.
Well, the big platform commitment they made in the election was to get rid of these tolls, and they got rid of them, and it's not something I see them going back on without some better plan or more equitable plan that they could pitch besides, oops, we fucked up, let's put tolls back on these two bridges. And there's a lot of voters who call them flip-floppers.
Yeah, the real lesson I think out of this is they should have tolled the other bridges rather than only have the two tolled, but, you know, nobody was running on that one.
At least it was a better plan than let's cap tolls at a certain point, because then we just reward people for driving more or not at all. Well, moving to other crossings, there's controversy with the RCMP this week. As it turns out, they have a special interview for guide that they've been using for asylum seekers who've been crossing into Quebec through one of the illegal border crossings. This follows the ongoing asylum crisis where people are fleeing the states or fleeing through the states to Canada, and because of the Safe Third Party Agreement, they're crossing at non-patrolled border crossings just so they can get around it. But it turns out the RCMP were asking each person that they stopped questions about, or at least they were asking Muslims their thoughts on their prayer habits, their views on women who don't wear the hijab, what they thought about female bosses, whether they supported terrorist attacks in ISIS. And some of this plays back to the Kelly Leach Canadian values tests. But the big issue here is it looks like they really just decided to target Muslims who are crossing the border. And because of that, Ralph Goodale, public safety minister, canned the document right away and ordered the RCMP to clean up its act.
Yeah, so according to the CBC article, this was something that just the local RCMP came up with themselves. Like, this wasn't directions from Ottawa. There's no big formal process to figure out what to ask people. And this, by all accounts, just appears to be something they threw together. And in addition to the minister quashing this, basically as soon as the story broke, the RCMP is now examining how the decision-making took place that led to this questionnaire. Like we talked about Leach's values test, there's a pretty good reason why this wouldn't work. Namely, nobody in their right mind is going to answer yes to the do you support terrorists question.
Not at least people who want to get into this country, who are, I'm assuming, people who are crossing at illegal border crossings. Yeah, the questions just even feel so patronizing and overly simplistic. Like, how would you feel if your boss were a woman? It's weird to me that that's what they felt the need to ask when someone's crossing the border. Also, I'm pretty sure there are a lot of non-Muslim men in this country who have problem with women bosses, and maybe they won't verbalize that when asked that question straight up, but given the rampant sexism in this country that's still ongoing, and North America, I'm not saying we should allow more sexists in, but it's a double standard.
Yeah, and it's not like any other non-Muslim countries where these are coming from are, you know, major bastions of progressivism on that front either. You know, we're not talking about asylum seekers from Sweden here, so it's, you know, singling out just the Muslims seems counterproductive, even if that was the goal to identify sexism. And finally, there's been some news in the ongoing saga of fighter jet replacements and the Boeing trade dispute. Canada's looking at possibly getting some secondhand fighters from Australia for some reason. Public Service Canada has quietly posted a notice on its website over the long weekend that they sent a formal request of interest to Australia to buy some of their surplus F-18s, and this is to avoid having to by the interim Super Hornets that were already a bit of a questionable decision from Boeing.
I guess the one advantage to this approach is the planes are already built, so we wouldn't have to wait on them.
Yeah, well, that in theory was the same advantage to the submarines we bought, and, well, that's turned into a whole problem and giant clusterfuck, and that's the curious part about this is, you know, we don't have a good track record of secondhand purchases, and one of the main reasons we need to get new fighters is because ours are getting pretty old, and I looked this up, the Australian aircraft, they were only bought a year after we bought ours, and I don't know what the Australian op tempo is, but if we're having concerns with metal fatigue in the airframes, I can't imagine the Australian fighters are in much better shape.
I think the temperature variations in climate in Australia are much less than Canada, so the airplanes might be in better shape. I don't know where they've been flying them.
Yeah.
But if they've stayed mostly in Australia, they might have actually been...
If you're getting up to 35,000 feet or in a fighter,
I guess going
from ground level to that, it gets pretty cold no matter where you are in the world. And plus pressurization and maneuver. Anyway, it's still a fairly major concern regardless of where the operating environment was.
I think realistically, this is just a way to try to poke at Boeing to get a better deal. And it's another tactic in the ongoing stupid trade dispute that won't go away.
Yeah, this just the whole thing seems like yet another example of how the Liberals are completely jumping from one place to another on this file and don't really seem to have a clear plan on how to actually replace the fighter jets, even though the answer should be fairly obvious because basically everyone's known we're going to be buying the F-35s eventually. But they campaigned against that and now they've stuck looking for something to make it work, kind of. And the options they floated seem that great. And this one might be the worst of the three. Well, okay, it's not quite as bad as just letting there be a capability gap with no fighters, but it's a very close second, I think. And that has been Plitos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at plitos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PlitosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/plitos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.